On this episode of Common Mystics, we discuss the incredible story of a successful businesswoman known by some as an abolitionist and civil rights leader, and known by others as a scheming and malevolent voodoo queen. I'm Jennifer James.
I'm Jill Stanley.
We're psychics.
We're sisters.
We are common mystics. We find extraordinary stories in ordinary places. And today's story comes from San Francisco, California.
Strange, Jennifer. How did we find this story? Tell me everything. Set it up.
Well, full disclosure, we have never been to San Francisco.
No, and there are wildfires happening there just in the region right now. Oh. So say a prayer for San Francisco. That's terrible.
Right.
But I would love to go.
We'll have to get to California soon, but where we were was New England.
It's true. We had left Newport, Rhode Island, and we were headed towards New Bedford, Massachusetts. And that's when, again, let's remind everyone, we're working under the same intention. Tell us what that intention is.
We asked the spirits to lead us to a verifiable story previously unknown to us that allowed us to give voice to the voiceless.
That's right. And we ended up in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Hook me up. Tell me all the hits.
Well, I was picking up on a woman's name that was also a noun. And in the notes, I wrote hope, faith, patience, a name like that.
Mm-hmm. And while we were driving to New Bedford, because I was so taken with Rhode Island, as you recall, and I was sad about leaving, I was like, why would anyone leave here? And we were talking about why people left New England to head west. We had an entire conversation about that.
Right. We were like, what kind of person leaves New England? It's like perfection here. It's so beautiful. It's so wonderful.
And then what else were you picking up on?
I was picking up on whaling and whalers. In other words, people who hunt or hunted whales.
Yeah, I remember that when we were looking for a parking space when we just got to New Bedford. Mm-hmm. I had the song, The Battle Hymn of the Republic, in my head. My eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. Yeah, it's a marching.
Yeah.
It's the battle hymn.
Yeah. Of the Republic. Yes, absolutely. We had no idea why, but I definitely wrote that down. And then we had this weird experience in New Bedford when we were looking for lunch. Can you explain like how that all came about?
So we park in a parking garage and we're downtown New Bedford and we cannot find, like, we don't want to sit down. We're on the move, right? So we're looking for like a deli, a diner, somewhere that we don't have to like sit down, and like a fast food restaurant, something that we can just grab and get back in the car. So we're walking around downtown and we couldn't find anything, but we did see a gentleman wearing a Chicago Bulls hat. And so we walked up to him because I was like, we're from Chicago. It's like my hometown. So we're friendly. So we asked him to give us directions to where we can get like something to eat on the go. And he suggested a little diner down the road.
Yes, a little cafe. It looks like Apeggio's. I'm probably saying it wrong, but it was a little cafe, super cute. So we go there.
Yes.
I had a parfait. You so had funny. A sandwich. A panini.
I don't even remember.
You had a panini.
I had a Mediterranean, or I think I had a Mediterranean panini with like mozzarella.
Right. That sounds right.
Yeah, that sounds right. But the thing is that as we were walking, we were getting the hits that we got in the car, but we had no idea. We were like, why are we here?
Right.
So we're in the cafe and we're sitting there and we're talking about how we have to get back in the car. It just feels like a waste of time. Why are we here? Why did we stop here? And as we open the door to leave the cafe, right in front of us is a historical marker explaining that across the street, the building that we were looking at was a place memorializing where Frederick Douglass had given a speech. So we're like, well, hell, there you go. That's why we're here. Mm-hmm.
Also, there was a big mural of black soldiers painted.
Wait. So that was right when we opened the door. Now, to get back to the car, we had to make a right, But we're like, okay, so this has something to do with abolition. This has something to do with slavery. This has something to do. And we made a right and we passed the area that we had walked quickly past getting to the gentleman with the Chicago Bulls hat. And as we look at the buildings from the different direction, one of the buildings had a mural of
Black soldiers. And it was very much a civil rights sort of theme that we were picking up there, for sure.
Not just Black soldiers. Across the street from that mural was the first place where the first regiment of Black soldiers were able to make their mark or sign their names to join the Union Army.
That is absolutely true. Absolutely
true. So we had, because we were hangry and we were like wanting to eat something and get back on the road, we rushed past this to find the Chicago guy, the Chicago Bulls hat wearing guy. And we didn't miss all of that until we walked out of the cafe and we asked ourselves, why are we here?
Right. And we got the answer, which was odd because we were not expecting to stumble upon a story about civil rights and the Civil War in New Bedford, Massachusetts. So that was odd.
To be honest with you, I felt like it was a nod to our story, the Black Brigade outside of Cincinnati in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. I felt like those spirits were... We're recognizing the story, yeah, that we had done previously about their valiant efforts in the war.
Right. Well, we did have a conversation, but as it turns out, it linked us to another story that would take us all the way across the continent to California.
How does that even happen? Tell me everything.
Well, let's start with the incident, shall we?
There's an incident.
The incident was the mysterious death of Thomas Bell. The setting. It was Sunday, October 16th, 1892. The place was the Bell Mansion, located at 1661 Octavia Street in San Francisco, California. The home was a monument to the success of its owner. It was a 34-room mansion that spanned two city blocks.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Humongous. Now, Thomas Bell was 78 years old. And he was getting ready to retire from his position at the banking firm that he owned.
Getting ready to retire.
I know, it's 78.
My ass would have been retired on a beach. There would be no way.
Mm-hmm. Now, he was an investor, a trader, a banker, and a merchant. And he had been in business in San Francisco since, quote, the days of gold.
Wow.
I know, like the gold rush. Cool. Isn't that fun?
Mm-hmm.
His assets were estimated to be between $1 and $2 million, which translates to about $34 to $68 million today.
Yeah, there's no reason for that man to still have been working. Absolutely no reason.
All right. Well, Thomas, unfortunately, had been ailing over the past 2 months.
Just proving my point.
And he was laid up in bed and had been for the past 2 days. It was noted by people around him that he was physically run down and also in kind of a dazed condition of mind.
What do you think that means? Do you think it means like onset dementia or some kind of Alzheimer's?
No, I was thinking that his cloudy mind had something to do with the physical manifestation of his illness. Like he had an infection somewhere that was affecting his cognition. That was my assumption.
That makes sense. That makes sense. So, Jennifer, So this old man's sick. Does he have family? Who else is in the mansion with him? Because I'm assuming someone's taking care of him. He's rich. He's old.
He was married. His wife, Teresa, was actually out of town with five of their younger children. And Teresa and the five younger children were staying at the family ranch in Sonoma County. But their oldest, their son, Fred Bell, who was 21 years old, he stayed back in San Francisco and was staying in the mansion with his father. Also at home in the mansion was the Bells' housekeeper, a Black woman named Mary Ellen Pleasant, also known as Mrs. Pleasance to many who knew her. And in addition were two young Black servant girls in the mansion as well.
Okay, so not a full house, but there's definitely people around.
Absolutely. So around 9 p.m. that Sunday evening, Thomas's son, Fred Bell, and the housekeeper, Mary Ellen Pleasant, both retired for the evening and went to their bedrooms. But the two young servant girls, they were charged with staying up and attending to the needs of the sickly old Mr. Bell, who had been bedridden since Monday.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Smart.
Absolutely.
The girls remained in the sitting room, alert and awaiting the summons of old Mr. Bell, situated in his bedroom on the second floor in the back of the mansion. About 40 minutes later, around 9:40 p.m., the girls heard a sudden thump and crash, and they rushed out to find Mr. Thomas Bell on the basement floor, twisted, banged up, and seemingly lifeless. So the girls were alarmed, naturally, and they flew up the stairs to the bedchambers of Mary Ellen and Fred. And they banged on their doors, screaming hysterically, "Mr. Bell is killed! Mr. Bell is killed!"
The basement. What was he doing? How did his body get to the basement?
All right. Well, I'm getting to that. So Mary Ellen and Fred both ran to Thomas Bell's bedroom, right? And they found, of course, that he wasn't in bed. His bed was empty. But the hysterical girls directed them to the basement, and they discovered him lying two floors below on the floor in the corridor. And Mary Ellen rushed to him. Now, she was a seasoned housekeeper, and she recognized signs of life. And she sent for blankets and pillows and tried to make him more comfortable. Now, Fred Bell went at once to fetch the closest doctor to the home, and his name was Dr. Murphy. In the meantime, they called Dr. Kearney. He was the doctor who had been taking care of Thomas because he was ill. Now, both doctors arrived about the same time. And when they got there, they concluded that Mary Ellen was correct. Thomas was still alive, and they transported him back up to his bedroom. The doctors tried their best to arouse him from his deep stupor. He didn't regain consciousness, however. But the doctors were able to take note of his injuries. His right thigh bone was completely crushed, Jill, in splinters from his knee all the way up to his hip.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. And his right arm was also shattered. And most importantly, there was trauma to his head as well.
Mm.
And the doctors indicated that the wounds that he sustained would have killed a man that was in robust health, not to mention a man of advanced years in a state of infirmity. And so they really had no hope for poor Thomas Bell. And he ended up dying at 1:25 in the morning.
With all those injuries, though, that's really a blessing.
It's true. Back in that day and age, there's really not much they could do for a shattered thigh bone and a shattered arm.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So those present pieced together the events that led to Thomas's tragic demise. Around 9:40, Thomas Bell, it appeared, arose from bed on his own and wrapped himself in a small blanket and walked to the bathroom near his bedchamber. And from there, he made his way down the stairs towards the kitchen, which was located two winding flights down. And he successfully descended the first flight, but then, for whatever reason, he dropped his blanket there on the landing and toppled over the side of the banister, falling 15 feet to his ultimate death. His death was ruled an accident. And the official cause of death was hemorrhage to the brain due to the fall.
Okay, it really does sound like a terrible accident, but I wouldn't call it mysterious. Mm. Dude's old ass was sick, and he was trying to help going down his fancy-ass staircase to get I don't know what, but like, really, what are you doing?
For real.
You have servants.
For real. And PSA to all you rich folks listening, call your servants for help if you want a nighttime snack, especially if you're not feeling well. Don't risk
it. Is that
it.
What he was doing? He was going to get a snack? Yes. Yes. Mr. Bell, what are you thinking?
Poor Mr. Bell.
You have servants on call.
He probably wasn't thinking
rich.
Straight. He wasn't thinking straight.
Oh, God. I'm thinking the indicator system was the little ringing bells in his room. He would pull the string and have the bells ring the girls in the sitting room.
I mean, I don't have that kind of detailed information about how the mansion was set up, but that's what I would assume.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just ring the bell, sir.
I know a lot of people of a certain age who, even though they need help, will never ask for help.
I know. It's really annoying.
It's like an epidemic. Like, you get to a certain age and you start to get a little wobbly and you don't want other people to help you, even though deep down you know you need help. Just put your ego aside.
I know. I think a PSA, let us help you.
Yes.
Let us help you.
We want to help you.
Don't deny us the pleasure of helping you.
The privilege.
Hmm.
Anyway, yes, you're right. It doesn't seem so mysterious, does it?
No, it sure doesn't.
The death was officially deemed an accident and no foul play was suspected. However, Jill, in the press, in the local newspapers, reporters suggested that Mary Ellen Pleasant, the housekeeper, was somehow involved in Thomas's death. And gossip perpetuated the idea that she was somehow culpable.
Okay, stop it. Shut up. I don't understand. Why were people pointing the finger at Mary Ellen Pleasant? Like, there obviously wasn't any notable evidence, or else they would have obviously looked into it, opened a case. Mm-hmm. So what's the deal?
Well, you're right. There was no evidence whatsoever linking Mary Ellen Pleasant to Thomas's death. For years, many people in the community, however, had questioned the goings-on in that Bell Mansion and the interesting relationship between Mary Ellen and the Bell family. And the situation was shrouded in secrecy then, and Jill continues to be surrounded by mystery even today.
Okay, you got me hooked. Give me all the details. Tell me everything.
Well,
who is Mary Ellen Pleasant?
Mystery surrounds this woman from the very beginning, and there are varying versions of her origins, largely due to conflicting stories that she herself told in interviews and in her own memoirs.
Interviews, memoirs, what are we talking about? We're talking about a maid in a house of a rich dude. Like, why is she giving interviews? Why are there memoirs?
Well, Mary Ellen had said that she was born a free woman in 1814 in Pennsylvania, but she also said that she was born in 1812. And in different accounts, her father was said to have been a Cherokee Indian or a Hawaiian merchant, or in another version, he was a wealthy white slaveholder from Virginia. And there are reports that she had been born enslaved between 1814 and 1817 in either Georgia or Virginia. So honestly, nobody really knows how her early life
started. So there's
nothing,
we know nothing for certain, like absolutely nothing.
Well, we do know that when Mary Ellen was a child, at some point, her mother disappeared completely from her life.
That's terribly sad.
True.
To have that one piece of information verified.
And Mary Ellen was sent to live in different white households. Now, it's not clear if these were foster type arrangements or if she were living as an enslaved person or as an indentured servant. But it is notable that Mary Ellen Pleasant had very light skin and one blue eye, and she was able to mix in either white or black society. Now, at some point, she lived with the Williams family and became known as Mary Ellen Williams. Next, she was brought to live with a wealthy family, the Hussey Gardner family. And they lived—
Are you a Hussey Gardner?
You know what? I am kind of a Hussey Gardner. I'm not a,
yeah,
I'm not a great
seen you
gardener,
out there.
But I'm definitely a Hussey Gardner.
Mm-hmm. I've seen you out there stretching and bending. Pulling and twisting. Say sorry.
The Hussey Gardner family lived on Nantucket Island. How fun is that to say?
I like Nantucket.
Nantucket, right off the coast of Massachusetts. And the Hussey Gardners were Quakers and abolitionists. Young Mary Ellen was raised by Phoebe Gardner and her husband, Captain Edward Gardner, who was a whaler.
Shut up.
Mary Ellen worked in the family store. And she was exceptionally bright, and she learned everything she could about interacting with customers and running a business. Now, after some time, the gardeners actually considered her to be family.
That's really sweet, and I'm really glad for her.
And Thomas Gardner, Phoebe and Edward's son, taught her how to read and write. And so she left Nantucket around the year 1840, but also always kept in touch with the family via letters.
That is really special.
I know. I
That's
love that.
Really, really special.
Now, she was in her late 20s when Mary Ellen left Nantucket to work as a tailor's apprentice in Boston. And while living in Boston, she met an abolitionist named James Henry Smith, and they married. Aww. Now, historians believe that James was either white or of mixed race. He also worked for an anti-slavery newspaper run by the famous abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison. He was a big deal in American history.
He was a big deal.
Mm-hmm. And so both he and Mary Ellen attended abolitionist meetings and participated in anti-slavery activism. Mm. During the 1840s, Mary Ellen and her husband James assisted in the Underground Railroad, helping people escape from slavery into Canada.
That's incredible.
Mm-hmm. And they coordinated the transportation of these freedom seekers through their contacts located in Nantucket and also New Bedford, Massachusetts, where we were, as well as through contacts as far away as Ohio and New Orleans.
Okay, shut up. It's a power couple. How did she end up without James on the West Coast?
Well, their marriage was short-lived.
Oh,
I know. They seem so good together.
Right, like Brad and Angelina.
He,
like Bert and Lonnie.
He unfortunately died 4 years after their wedding. By the way, he was abusive towards her.
Nuh-uh.
Yeah, he was.
You never said that
well,
in the outline.
Well, I know, but I'm telling you now. I don't want you to, like, glamorize their relationship because he probably beat her.
Up.
I know. I'm sorry. Not a fairy tale romance, but he died. Wah, wah. But, bright side, he left her $45,000. Yay.
Well, I say that is a bright side. Was it worth it, Mary Ellen? I think it was.
Well, I would say because that translates to $1.5 million in today's money.
And you don't have to deal with them anymore. Bye-bye, bitch.
Okay, so yeah, Mary Ellen got her inheritance and went on to marry again in 1848.
Mm. She should have just stayed single, I'm just telling you.
Well,
go on.
Her second husband was a black man named James Pleasant. James was formerly enslaved, and some sources say that he was working as a waiter in New Bedford, Massachusetts when he and Mary Ellen met.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that she's a millionaire at this point.
Yep.
And she's dating a waiter.
Oh, right?
That's really interesting.
It is very interesting. She's a very interesting woman full of contradiction, as we shall see.
Mm.
So yeah, they married and had a baby girl named Lizzie. Now, James took a job as a sea cook, meaning he was out at sea cooking for sailors.
Right.
And so for much of their 30-year marriage until his death in 1877, he was away at sea. So
wow. So it's like she married just to have a baby,
well,
maybe?
Well, I mean, when he was on land with her, he did help her with her abolitionist activities, and they did continue to work together on Underground Railroad stuff. But for the most part, she was her own free agent, and he would, like, go off to sea. So she had a lot of autonomy.
Yeah, that's not a bad gig.
No.
That's not a bad
no.
gig. But incredible the amount of bravery for her at that time to be working in, like, in an organized way to free people into Canada. Mm-hmm. That's a huge deal.
Huge deal. Yes, for sure. And not only that, she used her fortune to fund the Underground Railroad activities and other abolitionist efforts. And
that's amazing.
It was, like you said, it was super dangerous, a very dangerous environment for a black abolitionist woman. I mean, for any abolitionist, but certainly one who was, you know,
was black right. in that area. Mm-hmm.
She was harassed by people who were proponents of slavery because this is, you know, this is before slavery was abolished and people were all for it. Some people. And she was also, let's not forget, slave hunters who would come looking to capture people of color to then bring them south and sell them into slavery.
Oh, God, Jennifer. Okay, so.
And let's not forget, there were also laws. There are also laws that persecuted and imprisoned people who didn't help capture freedom seekers and bring them back to their enslavers.
So this is the thing. When we're pondering why people left, give me the situation why people left the area around the 1850s.
Well, there was a—
Hook me up with that.
There was a large number of abolitionists in particular who left New England and migrated to California around the year 1850.
Why?
Well, California was a natural draw for a couple of reasons. There was gold discovered there recently.
Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to say the climate.
I mean, Southern California is really nice, I hear. I've never been. I hear it's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. San Francisco too, right? That's mid-Cali.
I would think. I mean, you know what? To be honest, California is so big and has so many different climates. Like, you can get something of everything in California.
True that, true that. Continue.
Yeah, but that's not why they went primarily. Even though the climate's great, California's beautiful, it was gold. And when gold was discovered, that meant that you could go and potentially get rich fast. And also with all of the people moving to California because of the gold, you had a need for stores and saloons and hotels and all of the civilization surrounding all these people heading west, right?
Got you.
But also, California had just been admitted to the Union as a free state, which meant that the federal government said, hey, California, we're gonna let you in as a free state.
Yay.
So Mary Ellen migrated to California with approximately 700 other New Englanders. She took a ship. Smart, because I've traveled across the country. And I definitely would not recommend it, especially if you don't have a modern car and there are no modern roads.
I mean, I hate driving through the Rockies. It's the scariest thing ever. It is the scariest thing ever. So kudos on you, Mary Ellen, for getting on a ship. Equally scary, but in a different way.
True. So she took a ship and she stopped in New Orleans, because why not?
Well, I mean, if we're going there anyway,
if we're
passing it.
It's a given.
You stop.
You do. And she stayed. She stopped in New Orleans and she stayed there long enough to sign up for some classes.
Oh my God, what kind of classes?
She signed up for cooking classes with Creole cooks.
Oh my God.
Right? And she also signed up to study voodoo under the tutelage of the famous voodoo queen, Marie Laveau. Like, legendary.
Can you even imagine signing up for that course? I so would, like, 1,000 times over. What would it be like? What would the supply list be?
You know, we're making kind of light of the fact that she, like, signed up for a course. But what she must have done is, like, go find this woman and knock on her door and be like, hey, can you teach me your ways? Like, how else does that happen?
I don't know. I don't know if Marie Laveau was into teaching
people. I don't
know
either.
I don't know enough about Marie Laveau to know that, but—
Well, she was a big deal voodoo queen.
Exactly. That's like me knocking on Oprah's door, being like, knocking on Oprah's door, just being like, hey, teach me.
Right, exactly.
I want to be in your life class.
Yeah.
Like, that's not how that works.
Yeah, no. Yeah. As much contradictory information that was published on this woman, on Mary Ellen Pleasant, there is evidence that she was in New Orleans and she did work with Marie Laveau.
I will say this, as a psychic, and even before when I was a kid, I always believed, and I told you this, psychics recognize other psychics in the world. And I think if she did have the balls to seek out the Marie Laveau, right? And knock on the door and Marie saw her, I think Marie and Mary Ellen got along quite well.
Interesting.
I think that that's what I think.
So what you're saying is you believe Mary Ellen to be psychic.
And powerful.
Interesting. All right, hold on to that. Because so far, I have no evidence that that is true. Other than her, like, working on the Underground Railroad, which takes some chutzpah and some intuition to be able to do it and not get caught.
That's a really good point. And for as long as she's been doing it, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, continue.
And as a matter of fact, when she was in New Orleans, she had contacts to the Underground Railroad and continued to work it while she was in New Orleans. Now, this is the Deep South, dude.
desalinated in the 1800s. Mm. What are we, like, how does that even work?
Right.
Tell me how these, this is like some spy type shit.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
For like, sure.
That's.
Well, yeah. So she had to leave in a hurry when some of her covert activities were like beginning to be suspected. And so she got back on a ship and she hightailed it to the west and got to California.
Yeah, she ain't dumb.
Mm-hmm.
She knows. She knew where she had to go.
And she arrived in San Francisco around 1852 during the famous California Gold Rush.
Mm, sounds crowded. Mm. So what was her life like in San Francisco?
Okay, so only 10% of the pioneers coming to California during this time were women. Most of the pioneers rushing out there were men who wanted to, like, take a pick and go, like, dig in the river for gold.
That makes sense. So women and, like, mother figures were needed in California at the time.
Well, women and the female arts that they could provide were very welcome.
Oh, I was talking about sewing and cooking.
True, yes.
And washing their clothes. So, well, that's what were you talking
that's
about?
That's what I was talking about.
Okay.
And so, as an accomplished cook who had studied Creole cuisine, news of Mary Ellen's arrival preceded her. And when she arrived in San Francisco, she was met by a crowd of men who started a bidding war to employ her as their cook.
I love this woman so much. Can you even imagine? I would be among those men. I would be like, someone who knows some good cooking is coming up here. I would bid on her. Yes, I would.
And so Mary Ellen was readily employed as a cook at the rate of $500 a month. In today's money, Jill, that is $17,000 a month.
We're underpaid. We are so underpaid.
Now, Mary Ellen was raking in the cash as a cook. But
you know what? Good for you, girl. I'm very, very impressed. And I would love to have some of that cooking.
She also had a keen business sense, and she had managed her inheritance money very well.
Okay, tell me.
When she arrived in San Francisco, she had $15,000 worth of gold coins on her. That's $500,000 today.
That's crazy to travel with that kind of money being a Black woman.
Mm-hmm. But instead of like buying a big house and being all like, hey, look at all this money I have, she worked as a live-in maid and surrounded herself by wealthy businessmen as a domestic worker. You know what I'm saying? And when they talked business, she would eavesdrop and pick up investment tips. You see where I'm going with this?
She is incredibly savvy.
Mm-hmm.
Truly incredibly savvy. She did the exact opposite of what I would
do. Exactly.
What a woman.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Love
exactly.
her.
Using guile and secrecy, Mary Ellen started several successful businesses in the area. So she opened a livery stable, a tenant farm, a dairy farm, and a money lending business. She started a bank. She started a bank. She also opened up boarding houses and laundries. She established restaurants and would later come to be a co-founder of the Bank of California.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. For real. Of course, her wealth was not common knowledge at the time, and she handled her business affairs with the utmost secrecy.
This is crazy. She was a thriving Black businesswoman in San Francisco. So California must have been really progressive and really like for bring on all the
like Black power
the people. Yeah, Black power, bring them all on to us. Land opportunity.
Well, not exactly. I mean, California did offer opportunities to people of color. And there's this one sentence in Wikipedia that I thought was so apropos here. It says, as one African American miner wrote to his wife, this is the best place for Black folks on the globe. All a man has to do is work and he will make money. And there were many, many people of color who went to California and made money prospecting during the gold rush years. That is a fact.
Well, that's good. That makes me happy.
Right. And remember how I told you that California was admitted to the Union as a free state?
Yeah, I yayed it. I I said, yay.
Yeah, right. Well, that's kind of in bunny air quotes.
Why?
Because the introduction of slavery into the state was not limited by the federal government.
So in other words, it was established as a free state, but you can bring your own slaves if you had them.
Right.
That's messed up.
Right. So this resulted in a heated debate over the drafting of the California Constitution in 1849. In other words, they were arguing, would California allow slavery in their brand new state or not? Right? So this was a big argument.
I thought we settled this. You were supposed to be free. California, what are you doing to me?
No, but don't get confused here. It was established as a free state, but it didn't prevent people from bringing slavery into the state. So just because it starts free doesn't mean that people who are enslaving people can come and move there, right? And so that was a big argument.
That's BS. Yeah, that's
BS. It's a loophole is what it was.
Okay,
so
I don't like it.
There was a big argument over the Constitution of California. Are we going to allow slavery to come into the state or not? And in the end, the lawmakers agreed that the new state of California would prohibit slavery.
Good Lord. Thank you, California.
Are we going to get a yay?
Yay!
But.
God, I just yayed and now you're butting me.
Many of the lawmakers in the new state didn't want black residents at all.
Oh,
you see.
This is exhausting. In American history, this is exhausting.
They didn't want enslaved black people in the state, but they also didn't want free black people in the state. And there was a real effort in the 1850s to outlaw black immigrants from coming to California.
Hang in there, guys. We'll be right back.
Hi, everyone. We are so excited to unveil the first book in our series entitled Common Mystics Present Ghost on the Road Volume 1, Murders and Mysterious Deaths.
It's everything you love about Common Mystics and more.
It's a retelling of 10 of our favorite stories from our pod with exciting extras.
Extras like souvenirs, what we took away from the experience, and what to know if you go, if you decide to travel in our footsteps.
Pre-order the Kindle edition now. All other formats of the book will be available for purchase at Amazon.com on July 1st, 2023.
Thanks, guys. Now back to the show.
So did they succeed in enacting this type of extreme racism against African Americans?
No. Their efforts ultimately failed, but this really highlights the fear and racism that black people experienced at the time coming to the state. Like, it was not a given that you were going to be welcomed there, okay? It was still unsafe.
Honestly, for like a black person in this country, there's not even a friendly place for you, let alone a safe place. You know what I mean?
I mean, that would be true in 1849, 100%. So
it's frustrating.
When Mary Ellen moved to San Francisco in the 1850s, she used the name Mary Smith, not Mary Pleasant.
Well, that's a shame. Mary Pleasant just has a good ring to it.
I know. I like it too. And also, Mary Ellen lived among white society as a white woman. She was considered white by her neighbors in San Francisco.
Wow. So she had to hide her real identity.
Yeah.
That's disheartening, but rather brilliant. I see you. I got you. Mary Ellen, I'm looking right at you.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So the white people around her assumed she was white, but the black community in San Francisco knew her as Mrs. Pleasant or Mrs. Pleasance, and they knew that she was a black leader in San Francisco from the time of her arrival, only she was covert about it. And she continued her underground railroad activities in California, continuing to help freedom seekers escape slavery. You know those boarding houses I talked about? They mm-hmm. doubled as safe houses for runaways. Her businesses, they employed black people who needed a job. Mm-hmm. And she helped them find work and find safety and employed them and become acclimated to society. She oftentimes would buy them clothes and help just set them up for success. She actually became known in that community as a one-woman social agency. So basically, she was the go-to person if you needed something.
That's amazing. Good for her. What an incredible woman.
All of this covert to the white society.
She's unstoppable. It just makes me happy. All this happening as like their next door to her.
All just under the surface. I mean, it seems like she's just living her life as a double life.
I love it. I love everything about this.
Until the end of the Civil War, slavery is abolished in 1865. And it is then when Mary Ellen publicly begins to identify herself as a Black woman in San Francisco in the city directory.
Is she living on the same block?
Oh, shit. Yeah, she's living on the same block. And no. All of a sudden, all of these white people are like, wait a minute, what? Who are you?
OMG. Yes, yes, and yes.
Like, if I had known that, can you imagine, like, in their little white heads? Like, if I had known that, I would have been much more racist to you the whole time.
It must have blown their minds. So tell me, Jennifer, how did Mary Ellen Pleasant come to be associated with the millionaire banker Thomas Bell and eventually start working for him? Because she seems like she has things pretty tight on her own.
Well, it appears that Mary Ellen first encountered Thomas Bell through her business dealings. Now, some historians actually believe that Thomas helped Mary Ellen acquire investments and other assets by using his name. Think about it. It would have been difficult or impossible for a woman, much less a woman of color, in the 1850s to engage in the type of high-stakes investment activities that she was able to pull off. I mean, can you imagine?
That's amazing. She's a legend. She literally is a legend.
The white men in power would have been asking questions like, how does a cook have that much money? And also, she would have been vulnerable to people looking to take advantage of her and cheat her. But no. Mm-hmm. So Thomas Bell and Mary Ellen Pleasant proved to be a very successful business partnership. He allowed her to use his name, and he moved up in the ranks from clerk to owner of the banking company because of the assets that she was providing.
Wow. She is a good partner.
And together, the two of them amassed an empire worth $30 million, which translates to more than $1 billion in today's money.
It hurts me not to be jelly, but it's good for you. I think we should not be jealous of other women, but I am a little bit.
So, in 1870, the magnificent Bell Mansion was built at 1661 Octavia Street in San Francisco. And at the time, Mr. Thomas Bell had been a bachelor for decades. And he moved into the mansion, of course, along with servants, including Mary Ellen as his maid. And there were rumors from the beginning that they were kind of involved romantically.
Wait a second. You said there was a Mrs. Teresa Bell on the scene. When did that happen?
Actually, Mary Ellen introduced them to each other.
This woman is just a surprise and a half. What is happening?
See, Mary Ellen was known for having women protégés, quote unquote, in her circle. Now, these would be women that needed housing or clothing or guidance, and she would take them under her wing. Sometimes, if they couldn't support their children, she would assist them in finding homes for their children. Or sometimes, if they needed to find a rich man, she would arrange marriages between the wealthy men and her protégés. And by the way, Jill, many of these protégés kept meticulous notes on the men's activities, including like if there were skeletons in their closets involving illegitimate children or infidelity or political and financial misdeeds. And these notes may or may not have gotten back to Mary Ellen for the purpose of blackmail.
I mean, do what you got to do, you know? You don't get $30 million or $1 billion not playing it smart.
Well, Teresa Percy Hoey had been one of Mary Ellen's protégés. And Mary Ellen introduced Thomas to Teresa. And the two of them tied the knot only a few months after they met in 1879. Only a few months. It feels like there was probably like a spark there for sure, don't you think?
Between, I mean,
Teresa,
I guess,
and Thomas.
I think that if she was a protege of Mary Ellen, she was probably super charming.
Teresa moved into the Bell Mansion, where Mary Ellen continued to live as the maid. Now, early on, life in the mansion was considered mysterious, and it was also the subject to gossip in the community, largely due to this peculiar relationship that seemed to be happening between Mary Ellen Pleasant and the Bells.
I just think people are jealous. Like, what are they? Don't know anything. Why don't they just mind their own business? What is happening?
Well, the public thought that Mary Ellen, as the maid, seemed to have way too much power and influence in that household.
And I would say, mind your own business.
Much of Teresa's life was controlled by Mary Ellen, Jill. Like, she controlled, like, her life. Teresa was considered mentally ill. Now, we know this because her own children called her insane.
Okay, that's a little suspicious.
Right.
But you would think there would be a lemon law on her proteges, like Mr. Bell being like, this one doesn't work right.
Oh, my God.
And him, like, trade her out.
Wow. Like, some sort of return policy?
Exactly.
Or exchange?
But, like, this one messed up.
Oh, my God. Well, it appears that she had some sort of mental illness. And so Mary Ellen, and not Teresa, was actually the manager of all the housekeeping and the servants. Mary Ellen also selected Teresa's clothes and organized her social activities and even controlled the disbursement of the money in the household.
It really sounds like the royal family to me. I don't think there's anything that suspicious with that kind of money and with the servants.
Well, the public or the community did think it was very, very inappropriate. What's more, Thomas and his wife, like, weren't always on the same terms. And Mary Ellen seemed to, like, be a mediator between the two of them. And when people...
That's awkward.
That is awkward.
That's really awkward.
When people came to the house, she would often turn them away.
Okay. Again, that's a little overstepping the bounds.
For sure. Pretty soon, it became evident to many that the marriage between Thomas and Teresa was really troubled. And around 1889, Teresa and her five youngest children actually moved out of the house and lived on the family ranch while Fred stayed home with his father at the mansion in San Francisco.
Okay, so it is a very different type of marital situation that Thomas and Teresa had.
For sure.
But why would that, given, okay? And I get that, like, Mary Ellen was, like, turning people away. I don't know the circumstances, but I don't see how any of that would lead to Mary Ellen being a suspect in the community's eyes in Mr. Bell's murder.
Good point. But you have to understand how the climate changed around the 1880s in San Francisco and in other places across the United States.
Like, really, California? Pick a mood. You're, like, giving me whiplash here. Again, you're changing.
In the 1880s, racism was rearing its ugly head in cities across the country. And that's because it was an era where emancipated slaves were being scapegoated for the economic troubles that people were experiencing. And as a wealthy, older Black woman with power and influence in the Black community in San Francisco, Mary Ellen faced suspicion and also fear. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, but I'm over it.
And this changing social political climate may have been one reason for the vicious rumors that began to surround Mary Ellen and aim to humiliate her and discredit her. And so allegations were swirling around that her boarding houses were really brothels and that she amassed her wealth via magic and voodoo.
It still would be her wealth, even if she did. You know what I'm saying?
And then whispers grew that she had some mystical hold over the Bell family. And Mr. Bell's associates just could not understand how a successful man like Thomas Bell could allow his Black maid to control the finances of his estate. One headline in the San Francisco Call asked, "Mammy Pleasant, angel or archfiend in the house of mystery?"
That's racist AF.
Super racist.
Not cool.
And by the way, that whole mammy moniker is completely inappropriate today, but it was equally inappropriate then. And she said again and again, I'm not everybody's mammy. You put that down, is what she said. Put that down.
Yeah.
I am not everybody's mammy.
Yeah, I don't like even hearing it today.
I'm sorry. But much of her fearsome reputation was a result of Mary Ellen's own secrecy. Like, she lived her life like this. And it had been essential for her to safeguard her wealth. The truth was, Jill, that Mary Ellen, and not Thomas, had actually built that mansion and furnished it.
That's what I thought, because she and Thomas were investing together, and that's what his associates didn't understand.
Exactly. Mary Ellen controlled the finances of the estate because her money was inextricably intertwined with Thomas Bell's. It was her money as much as it was his.
Yep, and it was no one else's business what was going on in that mansion.
Exactly. But Jill, there was one incident in particular that captured the public's imagination and convinced many that Mary Ellen was a true voodoo queen capable of murder.
Let's hear it.
In 1883, Mary Ellen Pleasant became embroiled in a sensational trial of Nevada Senator William Sharon, accused of seducing and abandoning a young woman named Sarah Althea Hill. Now, this case captivated the nation, dominating headlines every day. Although Mary Ellen was not on trial, she was a close friend of Sarah Hill's, and actually, Sarah had been another one of Mary Ellen's proteges. And William Sharon's lawyers cast Mary Ellen as a malevolent figure, alleging that she had used dark forces to manipulate Sarah into entrapping the senator. And you know what? Mary Ellen leaned into it.
What? What does that mean?
Rather than, like, refuting the rumors, she actually, like, embraced them. And she came to the courtroom with a voodoo doll and was like,
oh, my God.
She was like, all right, we're going to play this.
The woman is a legit legend.
During the trial, she carried her voodoo doll into court and claimed that it would bring about William Sharon's demise. Guess what?
I would be scared. I would be scared.
Well, everybody was scared when, astonishingly, William Sharon died. He died before the trial concluded, and the press had a field day.
I wonder, wow.
Yeah, wow.
Wow, wow, wow.
So, yeah, for real, right? Like, that's a hell of a coincidence right there.
That is a mighty flex, hell of a coincidence.
Now, side note, we are going to have to talk about the story of Sarah Althea Hill in our Detours episode because it is delightfully wackadoodle. It is wackadoodle-do on so many levels. You are going to love it. This woman is out of her mind, and this story needs to be told. So meet us on Patreon there to hear about this train wreck.
Wow, I'm excited.
You should be. Now,
back to Mary Ellen. Please pick up her story. What is happening? What's going on?
Mary Ellen Pleasant was never formally accused of the death of Thomas Bell.
Good.
Yes. But his widow, Teresa Bell, her longtime friend and former protege, completely turned on Mary Ellen after her husband's death. And she went in on this full-page expose in the San Francisco Chronicle titled The Queen of the Voodoos. So she, like, fed all of this information to the press. And she,
my God,
Mary Ellen was maligned by the newspapers.
Did she not read about the Nevada Senator William Sharon? Because,
yeah.
She must have been crazy because I would not do that. I would be like, hey, Mrs. Pleasant, I hope we're friends, right? We're cool, still okay?
After this, the press transformed her into, an outright monster. There was no suggesting it anymore. She was a monster. They basically accused her of witchcraft, and they insinuated that Mary Ellen had murdered Thomas Bell. And Mary Ellen's prominence as a, quote, voodoo queen flourished, solidifying her reputation as a quasi-mystical figure in San Francisco. And by the way, even today, her ghost is said to haunt San Francisco. And there are ghost tours that tell her story because in the area where the mansion used to stand, because it's not there anymore, Her eucalyptus trees are still there. And sometimes...
Oh, that's so cool.
Sometimes the like nuts from the trees will be thrown at people.
I love that. And I want to go to San Francisco because I want some nuts and some leaves off that tree.
So unfortunately, Mary Ellen was really hurt by Teresa turning on her and feeding this information to the press. And she knew that Teresa wanted her out of Bell Mansion. And so she moved out. She moved out of Bell Mansion.
That's classy. Mm-hmm. She's classy, even though she built it.
She is classy. And I'll tell you something else. The press offered her $50,000 to tell her side of the story and give all the dirt on Thomas Bell and the Bell family. And you know what? She didn't do it. She turned it down.
She really is a legend.
Mm-hmm. Mary Ellen Pleasant moved out of the Bell Mansion shortly after Thomas's death. She died in 1904 in her 90s, and her fortunes were greatly diminished by scandal. Her obituary in the San Francisco Examiner was titled, "Mammy Pleasant Will Work Weird Spells No More."
I am disgusted. Screw you all. Let's be a little more racist, shall we?
I know, that's awful.
It's terrible.
So, Jill, why do you think Mary Ellen Pleasant wants a voice?
First of all, she's incredible. Even if she wasn't coming through asking for a voice, she is delightfully interesting, and I would love, love, love to keep researching about her because there's so much I want to know. Why do you think she's looking for a voice?
Well, first of all, I don't think she had anything to do with Thomas Bell's murder.
Oh, my God, absolutely not. I didn't even know that was, like, a real question. Like, no, of course not.
Right.
If I was going to be like, why does she want a voice now? Yeah. I think it's because she had to live her life in secrecy and to navigate the racism and the politics of the time. And I think if she's coming through now, it's probably to set the record straight, like who she was, what she's culpable for, and what she wasn't. What do you think?
I agree. And I also think that she recognizes that we've moved forward in a lot of ways, and she can be appreciated now in a way that she was not able to be appreciated in the past.
True. I want to like make saint candles with her picture on them. Okay, so let's go over our hits.
Let's do it.
Okay, Jennifer.
Yes.
Mary Ellen, she was secretive about her race, about her wealth, yep, about her abolitionist activities. Do you think she had other secrets that we don't know about?
Honestly, Jill, I really do. I really do think she had other secrets. Like she led a covert life in every aspect of her life. Of course she had other secrets.
That's amazing.
Don't you?
Yeah, and I want to know. Yeah, absolutely. A woman's heart. There's so many secrets. But where's her daughter, by the way? That's what I want to know. There's so much.
Yeah.
I want to know her daughter. I want to know like the generations after her, because she's an amazing woman.
Her daughter was initially left out east when Mary Ellen first moved, but then came out west and grew up and was married. That's all I know about her daughter. But yeah, her daughter grew up and got married.
Okay, Jennifer, let's go over our hits.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, your hit. A woman's name that was like a noun. Hope, faith, patience.
Honestly, this one blows my mind a little bit that I wrote down patience, and we're talking about Mrs. Pleasance as she was known. Like, that is so close. I'm really proud of myself. There is no doubt that she was coming through here.
What about you and I having the conversation about why people left New England?
It's like she was answering our question. She's like, I'll tell you who left New England, right?
Yeah, why would we leave here? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jennifer, what about whaling or whalers?
The Gardners, Phoebe and her husband Edward, were a whaling family. Captain Edward was a whaler. And by the way, Mary Ellen often said that she couldn't remember a life before she moved in with the Hussey Gardners.
That's so sweet.
I know. So that family really, really meant a lot to her.
You're going to have to help me out with this
one. Okay, tell me.
The Battle Hymn of the Republic.
Oh,
why is that significant?
Jill, are you sitting down? This is crazy. Okay, so I was looking into the Battle Hymn of the Republic because I did not know anything about that song. And what I found out was that that was a song that was written during the Civil War, which is where when our story begins pretty much and takes place. But
right.
It was from the northern point of view. And the whole point is it's the second coming of God, like coming to deliver, right?
Or the slaves. Right. To free the slaves.
The enslaved people, right? So it's God coming down, unleashing his wrath on people who are, you know, basically slaveholders or pro-slavery. So I did not know that that was the origin of the song. But what I found out as well is that that song was originally a song called John Brown's Body. And John Brown, you might remember from history class, was kind of a big deal. He was an abolitionist that thought the only way to end slavery would be to take up arms and fight. And so he, like, low-key, like, guerrilla style, like, led a raid on a place called Harper's Ferry with, like, him. He was, like, a farmer or something. And all of these other abolitionist people who, like, just took these arms and, like, led a revolt.
Yeah, there were poor white Kansas farmers, exactly. And they, like, had zero Fs to give. And they, like, organized and just started attacking, like, forts around the country.
And they gave their lives for this cause. And actually, it ushered the start of the Civil War. Like, John
what
Brown's
does it have to do?
Efforts.
I'm sorry. What does it have to do with Mary Ellen? Like, kudos, John Brown. You crazy, bro. You crazy. Let's get that down. You crazy. But what does it have to do with Mary Ellen?
As it turns out, remember how I told you Mary Ellen funded a lot of abolitionist activities?
That's true. You did say that.
She specifically gave money to John Brown. She funded John Brown and the attack on Harper's Ferry to the point where, at her request, a friend of John Brown was on her tombstone.
I have goosebumps.
Uh-huh.
That's crazy.
I know. That's quite a hit.
That's quite a hit. Especially because I didn't know any of that.
No, neither did I.
Civil War, civil rights connection in New Bedford, Massachusetts. How, like, dude.
Jill.
Are you kidding?
What I found out through this research is that Mary Ellen Pleasant is actually regarded as, quote, the mother of civil rights in California. Because later in her life, she had sued lawsuit after lawsuit of unfair laws in the state of California. She sued, like, a railway car company because they wouldn't allow Black people to be transported. She sued different institutions regarding their unfair laws. So really, she did a lot even after the Civil War into her later years.
That's amazing. And that's probably why a lot of her money was diminished at the end of her life. She was spending it on legal reform in California.
Right. She was a true pioneer.
True pioneer, a true fighter for abolitionist and for the greater good. And I know that's arguable, but I believe it.
I believe it too.
I believe it too. We need more Mary Ellens. I love her. I want to know more about her.
The thing to me that's so crazy about this story, and I keep going back to, here's this woman, and in 1864, she's identifying as a white woman, right? At least outwardly. And then 1865 comes, and the war is over, and slavery is abolished. And all of a sudden, she checks a box, and everything changes. But she's still her. Like, nothing really changed. But all of a sudden, this white society is now against her because of what exactly? She's the same person. She's doing the same things. It all comes back to their perception. That's all it comes back to. Before, they perceived her as a woman with certain social, political alignments. And then she checked a box, and all of a sudden, all their perception changed.
That's exactly right.
And it changed everything because then they assumed, rightly in this case, that her alignments were for Black people, and which they perceived to be against them as a white society.
Right.
And so I think it's just a powerful reminder about the power of perception, because our perception becomes the reality. We create the reality of our society based on our perceptions. And that's powerful, and it's also so dangerous.
Especially during an election year, that's so contentious, like this year in American history. So,
yeah, exactly. Yes.
So, like when you see people like flaunt their political alliances, you assume certain things about that person, right? And it's so contentious here that you're automatically like jerk or like, hey, bro, you know what I mean? Right.
But
that's why there's a lot of dog whistling.
It's true. But it's not just about politics either. The idea in my head that perception creates reality is truth. Your perception creates reality. That's true social politically, but it's also true in your life. Your perception creates your perception creates your reality. But the most difficult thing in the world is to change your own perception.
True.
Because how do you look outside the lens that you look through? And that's
meditation.
And also learning, going in, putting yourself in uncomfortable positions and being in places that you can learn something that maybe you didn't realize you could learn. So anyway, that's to me.
Oh, I love that.
That's to me.
I love that. Yeah, that's my favorite thing that you said.
That's to me the most fascinating thing about this story. So anyway.
I love it. Well, thank you guys so much for listening. Please check out our website, commonmystics.net. Follow us on all our socials at Common Mystics. Please like, download, and share. And if you happen to be on Apple, leave us a positive review so other people can find us.
Hey, and if you're not subscribed on Apple and other platforms, please subscribe. I think we're at like 450 subscribers right now, and we would really like to get a little towards 1,000, wouldn't we, Jill?
I mean, we would like as many as we can. So please do it. Please.
We're poor.
Subscribe on multiple platforms, all of them if you have them, and share us with your friends.
All right. Thank you so much for listening. Bye.
Bye, guys. Thanks.
This has been a Common Mystics Media production. Editing done by Yokai Audio, Kalamazoo, Michigan.